Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Why has the federal government been on a pink salmon buying binge this year? We'll have answers coming up.
But first, the Secret Service has a lot of questions to answer. And today, Director Julia Pearson tried to answer them. Ongoing reporting by The Washington Post is revealing how the Secret Service mishandled several incidents at the White House, including the most recent, September 19th, when Iraq War vet Omar Gonzalez hopped a fence, traveled across the lawn, and made it deep into the East Room. California Congressman Daryl Issa is chair of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, questioning Pearson and others. Today, he said the Secret Service's first accounts of that story were misleading. And then he said,
inexplicably, Omar Gonzalez breached at least five rings of security on September 19th. The White House is supposed to be one of America's most secure facilities, and in fact, one of the world's most secure facilities. So how on earth did it happen? This failure was once again tested the trust of the American people in the Secret Service, a trust we clearly depend on to protect the president.
NPR Washington correspondent Brian Naylor has been monitoring all of this testimony. And, Brian, there was that incident with Omar Gonzalez. He had a pocket knife. But in November 2011, seven bullets were sprayed into the White House. That went virtually undetected for days. Was Director Pearson able to give some sort of overall answer about what seems like a lack of transparency with these cases?
I think, Robin, that actually she may have raised more questions in her testimony today than she answered, about at least about the issue of transparency. About the case in 2011, she made it clear that she was not on duty. She was chief of staff at the time and more concerned about updating the Secret Service's technology than the day-to-day security at the White House. But she said basically that there were conflicting stories at the time that happened, and that it was eventually resolved. But I think part of it goes to the culture of the Secret Service. You kind of have to know what questions to ask in order to get the true story. In fact, we learned today, or it was confirmed today, that the incident just earlier this month with Omar Gonzalez, that Mr. Gonzalez, made it past the front door. Mm-hmm. It was originally the Secret Service said that he was tackled inside the front door. It turns out that he made it, as you said, all the way to the East Room before he was taken down. So there is just, I think, a culture of secrecy. I think maybe the folks at the Secret Service take their title a little too perhaps too literally, and it could also go to perhaps a lack of oversight on the part of Congress.
Today, all those questions came up, cultural questions, conflicting stories. But take us back for a second. For those who haven't really been following this Washington Post reporting, take us back to 2011. These bullet holes, where were the bullet holes? Who was home? What was the reaction?
Well, right. So November 2011, the president and Mrs. Obama were both out of town. Their youngest daughter was in the residence along with Mrs. Obama's mother when this occurred. What happened was a man fired shots with a high-powered rifle from Constitution Avenue, 700 or so yards away from the south side of the balcony of the White House. At the time, agents at the White House heard the shots. One officer reported hearing some of the shots hitting the building and things crumbling. They reported it. The Secret Service there were officers that were on the perimeter who heard gunshots, who smelled gun smoke. But they were told to stand down, that there were reports from eyewitnesses that there were people who were firing guns at each other, some sort of a gang fire or gang war, or also that there were reports of a backfire. So it took 4 days before they they're actually able to determine these that there was, in fact, a shooting aimed at the White House.
Well, today, Maryland Congressman Elijah Cummings asked Director Julia Pearson about the story as you just detailed it and as was published in the Post over the weekend, and how this relates to the culture within the Secret Service. Let's listen.
Officers who were on the scene, who thought gunfire had probably hit the house that night, were largely ignored. And some were afraid to dispute their boss's conclusions. Did you see that report, and are you aware of this issue?
Ranking Member Cummings, I too read that newspaper article and was troubled by those accounts. I have asked my Office of Professional Responsibility to retrieve the file and those records, what we know and when we knew it, if this young officer had made such a statement. I did find a statement that where this young officer alleges that they were reluctant to report it to their supervisor to be criticized, I believe was a statement.
So Brian Naylor, she was also asked if police on the White House grounds have the authority to use lethal force when someone's coming at the White House. She assured them that they did. Then, of course, the question is, why didn't they in the recent Gonzalez incident? Bottom line, is there a sense that her job is on the line?
Well, that's a good question. She was appointed by President Obama last year to change the culture. She's the first woman director at the agency, and her appointment came after reports of officers engaging with prostitutes in Colombia, after officers passing out in a drunken stupor in the Netherlands. And so she was brought in to change that, maybe that kind of old boys culture. And it remains to be seen how much progress she's made. The White House consistently says, and the president says, that he has confidence in her, and we'll, I guess, find out after this hearing if that culture has diminished. But if that confidence has diminished, but it is up to the president, and it's his call. And as long as he remains satisfied with her performance, she'll remain in the job.
And just briefly, you mentioned the other stories regarding Secret Service. What is the sense that the culture might change?
Well, she, Julia Pearson, has named a new office of cultural of ethical responsibility. She's put more focus on training, and so I think it's a work in progress, and it remains to be seen how much progress. It would seem as though not a lot is being made.
Brian Naylor, NPR Washington correspondent, on today's hearings looking into the Secret Service. Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, from the Secret Service to a part of the federal government you probably hear even less about, the Department of Agriculture, which has been on a salmon-buying binge this year. The USDA buys $1.5 billion worth of food each year, often surplus food that U.S. producers need to sell to make sure the price doesn't dip too low. The government then sends it to food banks to feed people in need. Well, this year, the government's shopping cart is loaded with pink salmon, which is usually canned, like tuna fish. Government bought 5 times more pink salmon than usual. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Carolyn Adolph of KUOW in Seattle reports.
You remember supply and demand from economics class. This year, the USDA is buying up $39 million worth of canned salmon to support its price. That's a lot of supply. It could buy the feds 100 million little cans of fish. And that would look a lot like this. This is the KWL warehouse in Kent. Manager Debbie Funk is showing me around.
So we're kind of right in the middle of the production lines right now, so we'll walk down this way.
Millions of bronze-colored cans stacked in pallet towers, each marked with a tiny number that says what kind of salmon it is and what year's harvest. Most have no labels yet. That's because no one's bought them. Once the government completes its purchases, warehouses like this one will get a lot of orders. That's when the labels go on and the government salmon head out the door. The feds are rushing to buy this salmon because there's too much of it in stock and it's pushing prices down. Meanwhile, new cans are rolling in because it's that time of year.
Wild salmon come out of the water once a year. They come out of water in the summer.
This is Tom Sunderland of Ocean Beauty Seafoods, one of the region's canning and distributing giants.
And then we have to work real hard to figure out exactly what the value of them is. So that's what we're doing right now, and we figure out every year.
The pressure is now on to deal with the glut.
Once the price is set, it's set.
At Fisherman's Terminal, they know exactly why there's a glut of pink salmon. Gary Stewart, owner of the Polar Lady, one of the biggest boats on the dock.
2013 was a huge year.
A year and a half worth of fish in a single season. And now that the supply is pushing the price down, it matters a lot. Here's why.
Pink salmon, the bread and butter of our industry, it drives everything else.
Forget the luxury salmon, the king, the coho, and the sockeye. The number one salmon harvested from here to Alaska is pink. It's not pretty. Fishermen call it the humpy, and it's not fancy. But the size of the catch, most of the annual harvest, gives it power.
Gotta be, I don't know, 60-70% probably.
That's what I would say.
Yeah.
And that means the annual haul of pink salmon has a far-reaching effect on the economy. Jobs are on the line, which means politicians in Alaska get involved. They campaigned the feds to buy more salmon, and the Department of Agriculture pulled out its checkbook. Because they all remember what happened the last time there was a crash in the price of salmon. It was back in the 1990s when farmed salmon entered the market.
Yeah.
Gary Stewart.
It just about buried the industry.
Stewart's friend Walt Christensen remembers what the price was before that crisis.
Actually, pinks were, in 1988, were over a dollar a pound in Prince William Sound.
And the price never fully recovered. And now, pink salmon is low again.
For pinks, they're not getting much. I mean, 60 cents.
As they talked about the government's decision to buy pink salmon, they both looked relieved.
It could have been real bad for the fishery if prices dropped any lower than they are with the fuel prices keep climbing, and they could have been disastrous. This is a good thing.
So what does it mean to consumers of salmon salad sandwiches? Here on aisle 6, a can of pink salmon is $1.70. It might have been cheaper if the government had not intervened, but that price will still get you more than one sandwich. And this year, the government's haul will end up at food banks, giving protein to a lot of people who need it. For Here and Now, I'm Carolyn Adolph in Seattle.
Well, a quick news note before we go to break. Some news breaking out of California today. The state has become the first state in the country to impose a ban on single-use plastic bags. Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill that will prohibit large grocery stores from using plastic bags starting next July, and the ban will expand to smaller stores in 2016. And there has been heavy fighting in northern Iraq today. Kurdish forces say they've retaken a key border crossing into Syria from ISIS. There is also fighting near Baghdad. And the BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is there and joins us now. And Lise, usually when we're talking to reporters in Iraq, they're in the north, but you're in Baghdad. What's the situation there?
Well, the situation here is like in many parts of Iraq, where the areas which are still under Iraqi government control, people are worried still about the threat posed by the so-called Islamic State fighters. They still control about a quarter of Iraqi territory, and that's after 6 weeks of Western and Iraqi airstrikes, which are aimed at trying to dislodge them. Now, the airstrikes did help to provide badly needed humanitarian aid. It rescued some communities who were besieged. It allowed the government, Iraqi government forces, in some areas of the country, the Kurdish Peshmerga forces, to take back a few towns, some key installations. But for the most part, all they are doing is holding the line. And that includes around here in Baghdad. We went out to see what's called Baghdad's protective belt, the outer edges of the city to the west. And to the west is Anbar province. And your listeners may remember that there were ferocious battles were fought by American soldiers for Fallujah and Ramadi against Al-Qaeda forces. Well, now places like Fallujah are in the controls of the Islamic State fighters, and they're just miles away from the Iraqi capital.
Well, how much concern is there at this point that ISIS could take Baghdad?
Inside Baghdad, the city is very well protected. After the alarm bells started ringing in June, when the IS fighters made their lightning advance across northern Iraq, taking the second city of Mosul and other strategic areas, security was reinforced here, and some of the prominent Shiite clerics who've long had their own men under their command launched recruitment drives and set up their own checkposts across the city. The question is whether on the edges around Baghdad, whether they are strong enough to withstand any attacks. The area we went to see with two powerful sheikhs who are tasked with bringing the tribes on board to work with the Iraqi soldiers took us to an area to the west around, again, another place your listeners will remember, Abu Ghraib prison, in that area, and pointed in the horizon. And I said, well, how close are the IS fighters? They call them Daesh here by their Arabic name. They all said about 5 miles away, which, of course, is not a comforting thought. And not surprisingly, they didn't want to stay on a road which had seen heavy fighting for very long, even though we were surrounded by gunmen who were there to protect the sheikhs and to protect us.
There is also, it seems, a question about just how much these Shiite militias and the Al-Abbas Brigade that you're talking about are on the same page as the United States. You spoke to the leader of the Abbas Brigade. Let's listen to what he said.
America has proven it always comes to us with the face of a savior. It hides in front of the people the ugly face of an invader.
And what about Britain?
We see that the British are the obedient slaves for America.
Lise, do these groups not want Western help in battling ISIS?
Well, you heard Sheikh Awas there, who's head of the Abbas Brigade. Its fighters have been fighting in Syria on the side of President al-Assad, and they are now fighting even more in Iraq, or at least recruiting in Iraq. They realized they had their own battle to fight at home, and it's one of many Shiite militia. We've also spoken to members of a militia set up by another radical cleric, Muqtada al-Sadr. He set up a brigade called Saraya al-Salam, the peace brigades, and we get the same message from them. First of all, they don't believe that Iraq needs a foreign help, and more importantly, they don't want it. They see the history of U.S. and British involvement in Iraq as being very sinister. They say history has proven that the West comes here with its own intentions. It's not here to serve Iraqi interests. And when you say to them, well, what can you do to stop it? There's already been hundreds of American-led airstrikes. If there are American trainers on the ground, for example, would you attack them? And you get different answers from different people. These are political statements, but it underlines that in addition to there being a military challenge right now, there is also a big political challenge in that the newly formed government in Baghdad, led by Haider al-Abadi, which is supposed to be a more inclusive government, still has a job to do to convince Iraqis that international help will be limited, limited airstrikes and training, no boots on the ground, and that, more importantly, Iraq needs it.
Well, and tell us about the political situation. This new prime minister is now perhaps most famous in this country for just saying that there was a threat against subways in the U.S. and in Europe, which officials here in the U.S. deny. Is he providing the necessary leadership on the political front to fight ISIS?
It's still early days. He still hasn't completely formed his cabinet. The posts of defense and interior are still not filled, and obviously those are the key posts. Kurdish members of the new government still haven't taken the oath, so that's another important element in this government if it is to be truly inclusive. And you may remember that President Obama has repeatedly hailed this government as being more inclusive. Haider al-Abadi is from the same predominantly Shiite party, Dawa, as the former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. But he's an engineer. He has a Western education. He spent decades living and working in Britain. So he's seen as someone that will be more inclusive, won't pursue a kind of a narrow Shiite agenda that Nouri al-Maliki has been accused of. But we've seen across the country that there are powerful tribal sheikhs, the ones who 7 years ago played a key role in what was called the Sawa or the Awakening, working with what were then many American troops on the ground to defeat the Al-Qaeda forces in Iraq. Those kind of tribal forces are not fully on board. In some cases, they're working with the government. In some cases, they're working with the IS fighters simply because they're disgruntled. They're angered and alienated by the policies which have come from Baghdad, and they still are waiting to see that Haider al-Abadi will pursue a different agenda. So that political battle still has to be won as well.
Lise, finally, you have been in Baghdad over the years many times, going all the way back to the war. And I just wonder how it feels to be there this time compared with your previous visits.
I have to say that even though the threat posed by the IS fighters is an unprecedented one, as one prominent MP said to me, it is an existential threat for Iraq, another group claiming sovereignty over the country. Those threats are real. But inside Baghdad, it feels safer than it has before. I remember on some trips where you, when you went out, you had to go in cars with tinted windows or curtains drawn. When you got out of the car, you could only stay for 15, 20 minutes. There are still areas of Baghdad that you shouldn't stay very long in. But for example, there's a beautiful park along the Tigris River. It's a park much loved by Iraqis. And I was so pleased to see that a park which had been closed many years after the US-led invasion of 2003, the park was now open. And the day I went to visit, there were children on the swings, there were football games. There was even a dog show going on, people bringing their dogs to be judged. And with signs of, you think that's normal life, but this is what Baghdad residents want, is normal life. But this is a city of blast walls, of checkpoints now. It's not really a normal city. It's not beautiful Baghdad anymore. And Iraq's war isn't over, but it's great to be back and great to see old Iraqi friends, because not even a war can break Iraqi warmth and hospitality and kindness and a great sense of humor.
The BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, joining us from Baghdad, Iraq. Lise, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for asking me.
And today, eBay announced its plans to make PayPal a standalone company. eBay acquired this hugely successful online payment system 12 years ago. PayPal's done so well that billionaire investor Carl Icahn has been calling for the two to split up. eBay seems to be listening. Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal joins us. Hi, Jason.
Hi there, Robin. Well, they would disagree with that characterization.
Right.
They said, Icahn, he had nothing to do with this. We decided on our own.
But why else would eBay let go of this hugely successful company?
What are the reasons? Well, and you know, we should point out that the company spent a lot of time and money earlier this year fighting Mr. Icahn on the premise that eBay would be better divided. That's where he was coming from. And they've come to the same conclusion, saying that, you know, this is going to enable their management to better focus on emerging challenges, that's the language they use, and opportunities, and to free PayPal to, you know, reach agreements with companies that compete with eBay's online marketplace. That's the biggest reason going on here from what we can tell.
Well, and just flesh that out a bit, because, you know, it seems like everybody's getting into the selling things business.
Well, yeah, it's a really competitive business. In fact, you know, last year, PayPal's revenue was up 19% to $6.6 billion, while eBay was up around 12%, which isn't too shabby, and it was at $8.3 billion. But the point being that the faster growing business right now is the online payment business. Mm-hmm. Now, shares are up on eBay this afternoon, but, you know, one leading analyst actually has cut his ratings to hold from buy. His concern is that eBay shares could really struggle in the near term, and that's for the reason you just said, that you know, that it's a competitive space.
Sure, people like Apple, Alibaba, everybody's getting into online sales. But what does this mean for consumers, if anything? There's 153 million people who use PayPal.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think that it's still a little early to tell. What we do know is that our wallet is going to be changing, and changing fast. And, you know, Apple is being the big disruptor here with their new payment service. And so all these other companies are having to respond in turn. And so you look at PayPal. They're trying to generate new sales independent of eBay's marketplaces. They have their own in-store payment options, like at checkout registers. And, you know, they want to be just, you know, just like Apple. They want to be, you know, an alternative to credit cards. Use your phone as a credit card. And I think that's the big shakeup we're going to see. But what's going to be interesting to watch is, you know, which service do consumers gravitate towards? You know, they've got a big head start over at PayPal, but, you know, Apple makes the phones, and it's going to come equipped with their software.
Well, so eBay says it's not responding to Carl Icahn, but he is eBay's sixth largest shareholder with around, I think, 3% stake. He's been calling for splitting up a lot of companies. How might he profit from this split, and why is he making this call?
Well, you know, as you say, he's been advocating this for a long time, and he put out a statement today, and he says, we're happy that eBay's board and management have acted responsibly concerning the separation, perhaps a little later than they should have. That's what caveat he added there. And he maintains that this is a no-brainer, in his words, that these companies should be separated to increase the value of these assets, both of them independent of one another. And yeah, in terms of it being profitable for him, well, at one point today, his value from those shares up $180 million.
Okay. Well, so there you go. That's why he wanted that divorce, one reason.
But just today, paper money. But yeah, that was today.
you say that he in general wants companies to split up, as other activist investors do, because it's good for the companies.
Well, you know, corporate breakups, they've really come into vogue in recent years. You know, companies are looking forward to, you know, simplifying their businesses. It pleases shareholders and allows them to focus more tightly on their operations.
Jason Bellini of The Wall Street Journal on this divorce between eBay and PayPal. Jason, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Today, University of California President Janet Napolitano told Politico that she wants UC schools to be the national model for addressing sexual assault on campuses. A task force led by this former Homeland Security chief gave a series of recommendations to the Board of Regents last week. And then there's the new California state law, which requires students to get some form of yes before having sex, the so-called yes means yes law. Will it have more luck than no means no? Here's a bit from the FX series Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
If the girl said no, then the answer obviously is no.
No.
But the thing is she's not going to say no. She would never say no because of the implication.
What implication?
The implication that things might go wrong for her if she refuses to sleep with me.
Oh, boy. So if some students don't get what no means, how are they reacting to yes means yes? Rishi Ahuja was one of two student representatives on the UC task force that drafted the new recommendations. He's a senior at UC Berkeley. Rishi, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How do you view the problem on campus that needs this task force?
The problem of sexual violence on campuses across the nation and here at UC Berkeley is definitely systemic in nature. We have a lot of students who, quite frankly, don't feel safe either reporting issues of sexual violence or have the information they really need to handle these issues as they arise. And it's a problem for both men, women, different genders, different sexual orientations. This is a widespread problem across our campus and something that really takes some sort of system-wide effort to fix.
So we have this task force making recommendations, but as a student, what did you want to see get in there? What got in there from your point of view?
The biggest change that I think is going to make a real huge impact on campuses for students is the creation of a sexual survivor advocate position. And basically what this position is going to do, it's an administrator on the campus that's going to advise a survivor of sexual violence and inform them of their rights and guide them to the university bureaucracy in terms of filing and bringing forward these complaints. And this is huge for students because essentially if you're a survivor of sexual violence, you're expected previously to go to the police, to the campus adjudication processes, to the Title IX office, to seek counseling all on your own. And that's the biggest change we really need to see on college campuses. And I was very excited that the UC recommendations are mandating the creation of these positions to help campuses guide survivors through each aspect of their university investigative process. So that's a huge change.
Well, will there be someone for the accused as well?
So that's a great topic to raise, and is currently a portion of debate. You know, at least in these recommendations, we're not creating equal parity for those accused in terms of a support that the university is providing. And I do think that would be an improvement moving forward to offer equality in the process, making sure that both the accused and the individual bringing forth the complaint have resources that the campus provides to ensure parity in the situation.
What about defining for students what sexual violence is? Again, California now has this yes means yes law. A partner literally has to say yes or nod yes, but also snuggle closer to indicate yes. And that can get murky, especially when people are drinking. Is there something that the task force is recommending to make it clearer?
So part of the task force is recommending is a clear kind of communication strategy that all the universities need to engage in terms of outreach and training to incoming students to inform them of what this looks like. And what that looks like is mandatory training for incoming students on what is consent and how to intervene if you see a situation arising where consent's not taking place. And that's huge because students don't come into the university knowing that if individuals are intoxicated, they are not able to give consent, and that alcohol is not an excuse for an act of sexual violence. And that's something we need to instill to change the culture for each incoming student to know that and to ensure that that's the kind of standard we're upholding for our community here at Berkeley.
Well, to California's law, the yes means yes. We understand UC Berkeley already had something like that in place. Did it not work? I mean, why the need for a task force?
So in February, the UC system as a whole passed a new policy on sexual harassment and sexual violence. And part of that was the definition of consent being the unambiguous and, you know, clear given of affirmative consent in a given sexual activity. But the task force, I think where it's really important is starting to specify, great, we've established what consent means, but how are we going to ensure that campuses are providing support, providing resources, mandating training, and all the kind of application that needs to take place. So the policy did a great job of outlining the principles, but now this task force is in charge of and really pushing towards, how are we going to implement this and make this a reality on college campuses?
Well, how are they? Because it seems like it would need money. Is there funding, for instance, to hire these people who are going to help people through the process?
And that's my biggest critique. The state and the UC Systems Task Force, they're not attaching funding to this. And at the end of the day, without funding, these positions can't be created overnight. And across the board, our state and the UC system needs to have our budget reflect this as a priority. And that's not the case right now. It's great that they're taking a lot of effort and putting a lot of attention into this, but it's another thing to actually put money and funds towards the creation of positions to aid survivors in the process.
Well, what do you say to people who say, but you're just on the tip of this iceberg here, unless you change whatever it is that's making this, in some people's minds, an epidemic, unless the use of alcohol changes, for instance, this isn't an act in and of itself. It's a consequence of other acts.
You know, I guess I would disagree in the sense that there are a lot of individuals on college campuses who drink and don't engage in these activities, right? Don't engage in non-consensual sexual activity. And I think that's a part of the culture that we can influence, that we can say that when you're engaging in sexual activity, it's not okay to be drunk beyond the point of being able to really know what's going on. And it's not okay if your partner hasn't really clearly indicated to you that they're in control and able to give consent to the activity. So I fully believe that this is a change in culture that we can create and that people can spot the signs and they can see when their friend is not in a place to give consent and they can step in and say, hey, you know, this is not okay right now. This is not consensual sexual activity.
I guess the question is, why is this violence happening? You're right. To blame alcohol on it is to take away personal responsibility. And I know that's part of the thinking. But why are there so many attacks, largely from guys on girls? Why is it happening?
It's hard to pinpoint on some specific factor, but there's something to be said about a general culture of what masculinity looks like in our culture today and what a lot of men think they need to behave in certain ways that prompts them to believe that this is how they have to act in a college campus or while intoxicated. And it's a big question, and I wish I had an easy answer for it.
Yeah.
But I really think it's about redefining how people view their responsibility to one another in these contexts, and for men to really understand that it's their responsibility to check with their partner that that individual is able to give consent and vice versa. You know, it's about establishing that as a community principle, regardless of who the individual is.
Rishi Ahuja, senior at UC Berkeley and one of two students on that task force to make changes to the university's sexual assault response. Rishi, thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's here and now, and let's think about the future for a few minutes. Not the immediate future, not even 5 years from now. I'm talking 50 or 100 years from now. Will there be flying cars, a high-speed train connecting Los Angeles and New York, canals in the middle of major cities to deal with rising sea levels? Will schools and offices look different, and should they? These are questions that people are asking in a relatively new academic field called Future Studies. Aaron Rosa is a PhD candidate in the Future Studies program at the University of Hawaii Manoa. He joins us now from Honolulu. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks a lot.
So what is Future Studies exactly?
So Future Studies is a pretty fascinating academic and consulting activity. A lot of people have the idea that, you know, a futurist goes around with some sort of crystal ball and tells people what the future is going to be. What we do is imagine many different ideas and images of the future and put them into conversation with one another so that we can actually make more useful ideas about what the future can be.
So you basically, you've got the ideas of what you think the future is going to be, what you would like the future to be, and you try to figure out ways to get there.
Yeah, yeah. We do a lot of study on what we call social drivers of change. And those are elements that really change society, change the focus and the drive of where we're going as humanity. And what we do is try to create other pictures, other images of the future that people find more appealing or more useful in their organization or community.
How is that different from people who just do strategy for a company or make predictions about any number of things?
So strategy is very much aligned with future studies. We tend to imagine future studies as being sort of the umbrella under which long-term strategy and planning takes place. So strategy and planning tends to be between, you know, 1, 3, 5-year plans. Future studies looks 30 or 50 years out into the future. People find waypoints along those long-term horizons to line up their short-term plans so that they know that in over the course of 30 years, they're going to be better positioned to get where they want to go organizationally.
Okay, well, let's talk about specifics and how this works in the real world. And I know that you used future studies methodology to help the Hawaii legislature deal with energy policy.
That's right. Back in 2005, we conducted the Hawaii 2050 state planning exercise. And this was a long-term envisioning process where people got together and experienced four different versions of what Hawaii 2050 could look like. And while those different images of the future were pretty diverse, one of the themes that came through that was we need in Hawaii to establish some sort of energy sovereignty. We are very, very dependent on the outside world for our oil and all of our electricity needs. And so energy policy emerged from that process that essentially has positioned and codified in Hawaiian law that we will be at least 70% energy independent by 2030.
I know you've also done work with the governments of Tonga and Singapore.
Yes. Some colleagues of mine and myself went to Tonga and introduced a new game system in which foresight or future studies was brought into conversation within governance. A lot of different people, a lot of different voices from the community were there talking to one another for maybe the first time.
About what? And what were they trying to accomplish?
Well, they're, you know, Tonga is a very small island-based kingdom, and they are dealing with some big changes in the planet. And when they look out to their future, they need to figure out how they're going to deal with sea level rise and climate change and how they want to continue holding on to their very unique culture and the society that they've built. So what we were helping them do is figure out, what does Tonga look like in, 100 years? What kind of values are they going to hold as a society? And how are those values going to be reflected in the behaviors and activities that people are doing on a daily basis?
It can't be easy, though, to get everybody on the same page about what they want a country to look like in 100 years, what their most important values are.
Absolutely not. But those conversations are worth having because the policies that governments put in place often dictate a lot of the behaviors that really start to shape how a society evolves.
Well, how often do people's ideas for the future actually come true? Can you really make a plan and say, this is what I want to happen in 100 years and have it actually happen in 100 years? The only thing I can think of that where that works is like the building of a cathedral that takes 100 mm-hmm. years to do, and they actually do it in the end.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are examples similar to what you've just said. Architecture is a physical manifestation of futures. But to what degree does that happen in, you know, social policy? Actually, a surprising amount. One of my kind of favorite examples is back in 1939 for the World's Fair, General Motors produced this series of videos, of films, in which they imagined 20 years out what the world would look like. And in that, they had imagined superhighways and suburbia and a lot of the things that over the next 20 years, they were instrumental in helping create. And it worked out great for them because they're automobile manufacturers and a lot of our urban structures now rely on or are built for the automobile. But then there's always a dark side too. If it's not a continuous process, if future studies isn't a part of the corporate culture or the organizational culture, you know, you go another 20 years out to 1979 and General Motors is facing a lot of crises. Urban areas have gone through many different periods of strife and conflict that infrastructure actually helped to promote. So to what degree are futures attainable? It really depends on the culture that's pushing for them. If the vision is something that everybody can get behind and work towards, they're very much attainable.
You know, I remember hearing an interesting comment from John Huntsman, the former Republican presidential candidate who was on Real Time with Bill Maher on HBO. And he said that the problem with the United States government is that they don't have a 50-year plan or a 100-year plan. This is what we want to do. This is where we're trying to go. And so start working on some really long-term things that they're working sometimes not even just from year to year, but just getting us through the next few months with the budget. They're not making long-term plans. Why isn't something like this, like future studies, happening in Washington right now?
That is a great question, and I would love to see more future studies emerge in Washington and in our national and federal government structure. Oddly, the United States actually has a long history of using future studies in one degree. Back in the 70s, when future studies was really getting established as an academic field, at the federal level, we had the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment, and they were a futures-oriented office that strictly did futures thinking in terms of technology. How would technologies impact society? What kind of policies should we be putting in place before technologies roll out? And there were a number of experiments across different states and cities and regions that were really doing futures work at, you know, at a grassroots level, building up these images of the future. What happened between, you know, the 70s and today, we have lost a capacity, an explicit capacity that allows our government to start articulating what it is that we want our nation and our place in the world to look like in 50 or 100 years. And I think it'd be great to build that capacity back into Washington.
Aaron Rosa, a fellow at the Hawaii Research Center for Future Studies at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, joining us from Honolulu. Aaron, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy. It was a pleasure to be here.
Well, let's do this right now and think about the future of the United States. What should the nation look like in 50 or 100 years? Robin, should there be flying cars? Should there be a high-speed train network all across the country? Should we have canals?
We're all going to be Venice, I think.
Yeah, maybe, right, with the rising sea levels. And cities are already starting to think about that. What does it mean? You can let us know your ideas for the future at our website, hereandnow.org. You can send us a tweet at hereandnow, at Jeremy Hobson, at hereandnow. Robin. We're a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I am Robin Young. It is Here and Now.